We'll call this meeting of the House Hess Committee to order. It is 2:08, and it's February 20th. With us today are Representative Roepberg, Representative Gary Davis, myself, Representative Con Bundy, and Representative Cynthia Tui. And we do have a quorum present. On today's calendar, we have House Bill 280, Human Resource Investment Council. House Bill 309, Improve U of A Debt for Student Housing. Or not improve, but they have plenty good enough debt that we'll approve. House Bill 229, Loud Vehicle Sound Systems and Confirmation Hearings for U of A Board of Regents. Mr. Croft and Mr. Thomas will be on teleconference for House Bill 280, and we will begin with House Bill 280, and we will hold the sound systems to the end of the hearing. Excuse me. On House Bill 280, Human Resource and Investment Council, Bob Ribidoux is here to present the bill. And would the record reflect that Representative Rice has joined us?
See, Representative Tui, Representative Bundy, I'm very happy today to be here on behalf of the governor and governor's staff to present to you House Bill 280. This bill has had a long history with Alaska, beginning almost 2 years ago when Representative Phillips began the initiative to allow Alaska to incorporate all of their federally mandated supervisory and policy committees that oversee the federal funding for many of the job vocational, skilled development and vocational educational opportunities in the state. Over $42 million in federal revenue comes into the state each year. These committees have the opportunity under a recently passed federal statute to consolidate into one oversight committee to help states plan for many of the opportunities that are coming down the pike as far as funding and perhaps respond to the block grant scenarios in a more cohesive and consolidated way. The bill that's before you today, House Bill 280, basically takes the Alaska Job Training Council, the Governor's Council on Vocational Education, and the Employment Security Advisory Council, incorporates them into one body, taking a membership that is presently at 38 down to a minimum of 21 and a maximum of 26 members. The efficiency and economy of scale that we hope to accomplish by doing this will also provide some initial savings, but I think that the opportunity more so presents itself to a more cohesive and effective planning body for all of the vocational education and job training skills that will be needed by the Alaska workforce in the coming decades. 21 states presently have taken advantage of this option under federal law. We have patterned this bill after after investigating all of the different programs out there for the Human Resource Investment Councils. We are looking at many of the provisions in this bill. Hopefully, we will be able to raise the debate as far as the policy making and decision making around vocational education and job skill training, placing it into the governor's office. If you would like, I will go through a sectional analysis of the bill. The Section 1 of the bill basically sets out the legislative findings and looks at the many job training and vocational education programs that exist within Alaska's workforce. We estimate that there are approximately 16 different groups out there that may apply in future for consolidation under the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council concept. Section 2 directs the Board of Education to consider the advice of the ERIC, which is the acronym for the Human Resource Investment Council, in the development of their vocational education programs. We feel that initially that almost it is a given that all education leads towards jobs and job skill development. Section 3 makes a member of ERIC a member of the Alaska Commission on Post-Secondary Education, and you will see within the bill that the post-secondary education is rescinded underneath this bill. Section 4 includes ERIC as a state board of commission and whose membership is also subject to the conflict of interest reporting requirements under AS 3950. Section 5 establishes the ERIC in the Office of the Governor, and we feel this is very important. The bill that dealt with the Human Resource Investment Council that was previously passed through the House and the Senate last year and was vetoed by Governor Hickel did not have this provision, and we felt that this was an important component as we dealt with all of the different agencies and the bodies that are proposed for consolidation under this act. The Section 5 establishes ERIC as the state planning and coordinating entity for certain state programs that are administrated under a number of different federal provisions. We feel that this will allow us to anticipate and respond to whatever funding scenario is passed down through federal legislation. And I think all of us who have witnessed what is going on at the federal level, that we had better be prepared for just about anything. Sections 6 through 15 provide the statutory and session law changes for consistency with the shift of responsibilities to the ERIC, including the deletions of references to the Job Training Council and the other councils that are presently under state statute. As set out in Section 16, we feel this is also a very important provision of this bill, and one that when we began to look at the different agencies that were involved and the different boards and commissions that were proposed for consolidation, we wanted to be sure that each of those had ownership and understanding of what was envisioned in the bill. And we planned out, because of the perhaps at time arcane requirements for some of the federal funding programs, job training, the Carl Perkins grants, that we needed to effectively make sure that we are maximizing the state's revenue from the federal level by not missing any of the opportunities under the existing law, but also as we began to plan a coordinated effort for planning on the state level to make Alaskans' plan unique to Alaskans' needs, that we needed to look at a sunset provision that would basically give these councils an opportunity to plan their own consolidation efforts, to give us some understanding of how their missions and all of their different funding requirements would be met, and that we would ask them to propose their own terms of consolidation out 18 months. We hope that after the inception of this bill with the creation of the ERIC on July 1st of 1995, we will have the ERIC fully in place and empowered with the different missions of the consolidated boards and commissions by July 1st of 1996. The sections 18 and 19 are talk to the specific federal requirements for reporting from the private industry councils and the other existing regional development councils out there who have in the past reported and been very effective in relaying the needs of the Alaska workforce to the state legislature and to the oversight and representative committees. One of the things that we feel is probably the most important aspect of this bill is that it is something that has brought together the needs and the desires of the agencies to fulfill their requirements on job skills and vocational education on the part of the Alaska workforce. And also, with the different councils and commissions, we have gone and explained our provisions to them. We have recently, in June, had a joint meeting of all of the commissions and boards that are proposed for consolidation. They have, each of them has supported this concept and come to you today to testify to that fact. At this point, I'd open myself to any questions. We do have standing by representatives from each of the councils and commissions ready to testify, to talk to their own specific reasons behind why they feel this is an important move for the Alaska workforce and training skill development community. And we also have many of the agencies standing by here to answer any concerns that you might have about their requirements for meeting the federal requirements for funding, and also if there are any concerns on your part as far as the staffing patterns.
All right, thank you. It is a major piece of the legislation, and so I think we probably will appreciate input from various folks. At this point, are there questions for Mr. Ribidoux? Representative Tui?
No.
Hearing none, I assume you will be with us for the remainder of the hearing. I would like to go to the teleconference first, and then we will come back to Juneau for those people that would like to testify. In Anchorage, on teleconference, Deborah Call, can you hear us, please? Anchorage, are you online? We'll try Matt Sue while we're waiting for Anchorage. Matt Sue, are you online?
Yes, we are. My name is Jan Catlow. I'm a private industry council member serving for the Anchorage Mass Service Delivery Area. I wish to commend everyone on the efforts that have been made towards the development of the Human Resource Investment Council. And there's great effort also going on at this time in the state to see if there can be three pilot projects in the nature of career development centers that, of course, would house a lot of these agencies and make a much improved service for our people in the state of Alaska. It's my understanding that each career development center will be placed in each of the SDAs throughout the state. I think the concern that I would like to share with you this afternoon is the concern I have is that there maybe is a possibility that the way these seats are configured for the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council, there may be not a strong link with the local community and the local people. The Job Training Partnership Act program is throughout the state and is very effective in all local communities throughout the state. And I think if perhaps a provision could be made, for example, like in line 9 and 10 under 5, the statement there is that there would be four representatives from business and industry. What if we included in that statement with at least two representatives from a private industry council representing private sector business? There's also an opportunity in line 22. Line 22 states something like at least one and up to four additional members of the private sector to assure a private sector majority and regional and local representation on the council. Perhaps we can add there with at least one member from the private industry council representing private sector business. Also, I noted in the bill that there is an opportunity for non-voting members. And in order to keep the link strong at each of the local areas to ensure that there is continuity and stability in our service of employment and training programs, perhaps we could consider membership in the non-voting segment for the service delivery area managers. There are three service delivery area managers. These are the people that have worked on all ends of the employment and training segment. They work with the council, the governor's office, then they come back home, they work with the staff, and they work with the people in the local region. These people over the years have developed a lot of expertise and professionalism. They have seen what will work and what won't work, and my thoughts are that we're entering a time of great change. We're looking at career development centers. Congress is talking about block grant systems, and we're talking about a human resource investment council, and these are very positive moves to the future. And anyone that I've talked with has well received these ideas and notions. It's just that I want to be sure we have a strong link to our local people, to the people that we serve, to our participants, and that remains stable and continuous. Thank you.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Toohey?
Thank you for your testimony. And looking over this list, I really feel that we there is a wide representation from private sector businesses. It's broader than any other sector.
Yes, you're quite right, Madam Tilly. My concern here is that people who have been involved with the employment have spent many years working with the Private Industry Council. Many of the council members are private sector business people. I would hate for us to set that talent and that knowledge that they have developed over the years aside all over again, like reinventing the wheel. And perhaps if where in the bill it states private sector businesses, we could give a couple of those seats or so to private industry council members who are extremely involved in employment and training projects to help maintain the stability of the program, the continuity of employment and training, and to bring to the table their broad scope of knowledge.
Thank you. I appreciate your testimony, and I agree with you, but I think that, again, I go back to line 24 of page 4 of the bill, and it says additional non-voting. If you feel that when if and when this bill passes and this this commission is made up, and this is where this we can balance this, is on line 24, additional non-voting members. But I think that We'll certainly the governor's office will certainly take into consideration your concerns.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. And for the record, let me recognize the presence of Representative Robinson. She arrived some time ago. And now we'll go to Anchorage. And in Anchorage, Deborah Call.
Yes. Thank you. Thank you, Representative Bundy and Dewey. What I'd like to do is do this presentation. My name is Deborah Call, and I currently serve as the Alaska Job Training Council Chair. I apologize for missing the last call that you had because we were trying to figure out the machinery here. What I'd like to do is prepare just a quick presentation for you, but what I'd like to do at this point is ask the previous chair for the Job Training Council to give you a real brief history of how this legislation developed. And then I can bring you currently, very briefly, with where we're at today on the national forefront. So I would like to ask the previous past or the past chair for the Job Training Council, Sarah Scanlon, to speak a few minutes on how this bill has gotten to this point today. So you'll have the thread and the foundation for why we're at this point today. So Sarah, could you please?
Thanks, Deb. I'm Sarah Scanlon, and I'm currently the Vice President of Human Resources for NANA. We have 1,000 employees. I represent the private sector today. This issue of consolidating our state human resource initiatives has been ongoing for more than 10 years. And as some of you are aware, we have in the past attempted to push some policy through and unfortunately have not yet been able to do that. There are a number of reasons that have already been mentioned for doing so. Unfortunately, last year's bill was vetoed by our former governor, and as I understand it, it was for state agency interference, which we hope you will help us not have happen this year. We have a need to consolidate the many human resource investment programs that are out there for a number of reasons. Our world economy demands that these changes move us towards preparing a quality workforce. In the private sector, we just cannot tolerate anymore having these fragmented systems out there that make it difficult for us to find decent employees to fill the many jobs that we have available. Additionally, the lack of a connection to the education system, the lack of conversation between the state and federal programs for preparing a workforce have not occurred. We see this as the major opportunity to do that. We also sense that the consolidation of the many councils is going to eliminate all of the waste that is occurring in the multiple councils and staff. The travel for a bunch of people doing the same thing is unnecessary. We fully support what the bill attempts to do in eliminating that waste so that there is more money available for the delivery system, particularly at a time when all of us are struggling with dwindling resources. So this is one of those bills that makes sense to the private sector. It makes sense to the state employees. They want to do a better job. It's going to force everybody to talk to each other more, to work more closely together, and to have a system that is driven by what the customer's needs are. For too long, we've had a system that pays too much attention to what the state workers want to do, what the federal requirements are, and we haven't given enough attention to the end product and what that customer wants. So in a nutshell, this is beyond its time. We sincerely hope that you will support this bill. We totally endorse the reasons behind it, and I know I speak for a large number of employers out there in the other work that I do in the private sector with human resource development issues.
Thank you. And Ms. Call?
Yes. I will briefly bring you up to date as far as what is happening currently. I currently serve as the chair of the Job Training Council and also serve as a member of the National State Job Training Council chairs. We have been meeting on a semi-annual basis to track what is going on in Congress. Currently, there are five bills in Congress that propose to consolidate employment training programs on the federal level. What that means, and as our previous speaker spoke to, is that we will be receiving at some point block grants. That's what we fully anticipate. With block grants, the state of Alaska will be setting the priorities on employment and training programs, where those monies will go, for what purpose they will be directed towards. And it looks very promising that Congress will pass one of the bills. In particular, I would expect Kassenbaum's bill in the Senate. Probably got a good possibility because of the Republican majority. In the House, it probably will be McEwen. Both of those bills do propose to consolidate, and McEwen's bill in particular proposes four block grants for each state, covering certain populations that are in need of employment and training. It's my understanding that I heard at one of the meetings that we had a month ago that Senator Stevens is very much in support of our efforts on this particular piece of legislation that's before you right now. Because he sees that nationally, the consolidation is an issue that is being talked about. Is there any questions I can answer?
None at the moment. Thank you. I'd like to come back here to Juno now. We have Jerry Lewis signed up to testify, and Ms. Rubidoux, you had indicated a number of other folks would like to testify. Let me put this sheet here on the table, and if people do choose to testify, if they would sign up on our sheet, please.
My name is Jerry Lewis, and I'm the Executive Director of the Governor's Council on Vocational Education. I represent Bundy and Representative Tui, members of the committee. The Governor's Council just completed on March the 31st a biennial report that dealt with the coordination of the Job Training Partnership Act, their delivery system, and the vocational education delivery system. And out of that biennial report, the following recommendation was made. The Governor's Council on Vocational Education is committed to helping promote VOC-Ed JTPA coordination in the state of Alaska. After reviewing the JTPA delivery system and its coordination with vocational education programs along with current national trends, the Governor's Council on Vocational Education recognizes the necessity of the formation of a Human Resource Investment Council. The specific provision of the JTPA amendments that most significantly affect the cooperation with VOC-Ed and other systems concerns the Human Resource Investment Council, which the JTPA amendments empower a governor to establish as a means of coordinating and integrating JTPA, VOC-Ed, and other systems of human resources development. HB 280 facilitates this integration, and the Governor's Council on Vocational Education concurs with its premise. The expected benefit of this recommendation is the development of a statewide system that will serve all Alaskans more efficiently. Additionally, in order to accommodate a comprehensive system, we would recommend that the School to Work Transition Council be included under the umbrella of the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council, and there are others that they're looking at also. To neglect this would be to fall short of the complete consolidation necessary to avoid fragmentation of programs, resources, and the possibility of duplicated services. One of the members of our council, David Stone, wanted to be here this afternoon to testify also, but he's with the mining symposium and the trade show and had meetings planned this afternoon, so he sends his apologies in not being able to support this afternoon this position. Any questions?
Mr. Chairman, a quick question. Are you asking for a specific slot for school to work?
We're asking for school to work be included in the programs that they're looking to go in there.
I think that's probably
because it's critical.
Absolutely given. Yeah. Thanks.
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Jerry, one of the first callers on teleconference referred to a slot for private industry councils. And on page 4, line 10, it indicates four representative of business and industry with at least one representative from a private industry councils appointed under 29 U.S.C. 1512. What do those federal statutes relate to the private industry council that we have in place now?
The Job Training Partnership Amendments of 1992 are the ones that will allow the creation of this Human Resource Investment Council. And they specifically had a percentage of the representatives on the council. They have a percentage has to be from the private sector, a percentage it has to be union, a percentage from the public sector. And that the creation and the numbers that they came up with, the 21 to 26, mm-hmm. was to fit that formula. One other area, the Governor's Council on Vocational Education is required under the Carl D. Perkins Act, which is up for reauthorization right now. And the administration bill has been submitted. Senator Kennedy and Representative Clay put the administration's bill out. And actually, a committee is working on the committee's bill. And that's going to change the Carl D. Perkins Act considerable. And the administration bill in itself eliminates Section 112, which requires that there be a state council on vocational education. And so with the elimination of that council, you will need something in place within the state to handle the block grants that everyone sees coming down. And one of the things they're looking at is they don't know whether it's going to be one block grant right now or four, depending on which bill in Congress you're looking at in Washington there. So having a Human Resource Investment Council in place when the legislation is passed will facilitate our state in being ahead of the game, I believe.
So, if I might follow up, so the current private industry council that is in place in Alaska now, there is a private industry council in place, and it was formed under this the stated U.S. code here?
There's more than one private industry council.
Right.
The statewide private industry council, which is the our member, David Stone, is the chair of that council here in Juneau. They just completed their last meeting yesterday, I believe. Yes, but it is under the authorization of that, I believe.
Okay. No further questions. Well, thank you. And moving on here in Juneau to Rebecca Nance.
Co-Chair Bendy, Co-Chair Tui, members of the committee. I'm Rebecca Nance, and I'm the Director of the Employment Security Division for the State of Alaska. The Alaska Department of Labor is in support of the Alaska Human Resource Investment Council legislation for a variety of reasons. We believe that Alaskans are the most important resource that we have in the state. And we believe that it's good public policy because the bill provides for the coordination and consolidation advocated by the public for more efficient and streamlined and effective government. We believe also that it's good for the Department of Labor because it will help us realize our mission of promoting the wage earner of our state and assuring that Alaskans will obtain the training that they need in order to be competitive for the available jobs that we have in the state, reducing the need to rely on the non-resident workforce that's currently coming into the state. Also, as a partner in delivering the jobs program, we feel that this bill will strengthen our ability to get welfare recipients back to work. It will provide a little more flexibility in terms of delivering our systems. And lastly, with the creation and implementation of this legislation and the HRIC in Alaska, we will be poised and ready to receive the federal block granting that seems imminent for employment and training programs. Any questions?
Seeing none, we thank you.
Thanks.
Let her off the hook.
Yeah. Decided to not have any sharks today. Jack Shea.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Your Honor. Ladies and gentlemen, I'm Jack Shea from Ketchikan. I represent myself.
Jack, why don't you come right on up here to the microphone, if you would.
Did you hear that?
We got you.
Thank you. I formerly served on the Job Training Council and the Private Industry Councils under four different governors, and I was also the Director of Employment Security Division, even as Ms. Nance here is now. That's the under the aegis of which serves the Employment Security Advisory Council. And so I've been involved in training programs and private industry councils for quite some time. I must disagree mildly with a lady from MATSU who had a concern that perhaps there wouldn't be enough private industry involvement in this council. I think I'm virtually sure that there will be. And in fact, it's designed into the law and it's part of the Job Training Partnership Act. In addition to that, Sarah Scanlon said it pretty well. We've been working on this for quite some time. I'm currently retired and I'm still interested in this arena, however, because as I agree very strongly that that's indeed one of our most important resources, and that's Alaskans. The feds came up with the enabling legislation for this kind of provision. As a matter of fact, it was even more than that. It was kind of encouraging legislation to consolidate these bodies, focus more narrowly on the problems at hand, avoid duplication of efforts, and generally coordinate all of the provisions of employment and training. So I think it's really a good idea. I think that there might be one possible amendment you might consider, and that is the way it's currently designed, there are 23 to 26 members on the council. That seems to be rather unwieldy. I've served on other bodies that had that many members. If there was some good way of perhaps reducing the number, and I don't have any cogent suggestions at this time, I would urge looking into it. Once again, the Job Training Partnership Act does require a certain percentage of persons. It requires, in fact, a majority of the private industry to be a member of the council, and I think that's apparent in this. If there's some way to do that, that would be a good idea. But other than that, drawing on my many years in this endeavor, I would say this is a splendid legislation. I urge its passage with all deliberate speed. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Representative Robinson.
Yeah, Jack, just from your experience, and probably should ask the others also, when I read through here, I'm trying to figure out where do the recipients of these services fit in, and, you know, on the board and those sort of things, and was curious, where did you see that from your...
That's an excellent question, Representative Robinson.
The recipients don't seem... doesn't know the answer.
Yeah, there you go. Yeah. Well, I don't know.
But I think we have the answer right behind you.
I'll ask the appropriate thing.
Okay. Of course, this is involved in the design of policy and not in delivery of actual services and procedures. I think that our cohort here will agree with the fact that the bottom line is training the individuals for jobs that exist in the labor market. And I've never lost sight of that, and I believe this is pointed towards that.
All right, I thank you.
Thank you, sir.
And Mr. Ribadeau, if you would rejoin us, is there anyone else in the audience who would like to testify on this bill? I would ask you to speak to the fiscal note. It's a consolidation. Hopefully it should save some money. I notice a bunch of zero fiscal notes, but then a significant fiscal note to set the wheels in motion here. Do you have a grasp of what is involved as far as what we might save through consolidation? I understand an efficiency of operation and maybe better service, but if we get to the hard part about funding.
Well, it all does boil down to dollars and cents. And I think we need to concentrate more on the cents part of it. This is not more, by efficiency of scale, from dropping from 38 to 23 to 26 members, we feel that there will be a slight economy of meeting. We feel that there will not be duplication of effort. We're looking at doing a lot of the initial work in subcommittees. We feel there will be standing subcommittees of this group who will report on some specific parts and portions of the job training and vocational education aspects around the state. The dollars that are reflected in the fiscal note, all are interagency transfers. These are dollars that are already identified by the enabling federal legislation to go and do the coordination, the planning, the responsible oversight, and looking at how to more efficiently deliver the product. We feel that we need to take what has been perhaps in the past. We identified, as we went back through the 10 years that this has been going on, 9 PCNs that have been formally allocated through different scenarios to the ongoing policy development under the federal guidelines. We are presently with three PCNs that are servicing these three councils, as well as a lot of in-kind donations from the agencies under which these councils exist. We are looking at consolidating those three PCNs into one and adding a higher level staff person at, not higher level than those that exist right now, but a staff person in the governor's office who will bring what we feel is the private industry's concerns to a higher policy level debate on a daily basis. We hope that that by the consolidation effort that we see, that the efficiency of delivery, and as Representative Robinson talked about, where are the people who are the consumers, the customers of this delivery system? We feel that the private industry, in all of its aspects, whether it's the employers or the employees, are the customers. And we feel that the efficiency in planning, the long-term policy and strategic development that we could envision under the Human Resource Investment Council idea, we will perhaps make more sense out of it, but in the initial long run, there will not be significant savings.
Thank you. Would you care to address the concern expressed by Mr. Shea? I mean, we have a caucus of 25. I have some idea what it's like to achieve consensus.
I've operated many years, as Representative Davis will tell you, with many large-size groups. And I'll tell you that as we looked at the federal legislation, we pared this down as closely as we could and still meet the requirements of the enabling federal laws right now. And we feel it's imperative that we maximize our resources from the federal government, that we do not give any opportunity for any of these federal programs to come back and say, well, you did not meet our requirements, so therefore you're going to be audited and we could lose some funding. As we looked at the different scenarios that we could come up with, 21 was the minimum. We feel that everyone needed to come to the table on this with a private sector majority, and that is what boosted it up to the 23 members, that we had to have the agency, the line agency commissioners involved, and then we also had to have a private sector majority. In doing so, we got to 23. We feel that many of the day-to-day working aspects of this council will be handled in subcommittees that are specifically targeted for the Carl Perkins grant, the oversight of the UI Trust Fund. We feel that those will be handled and reported back to the general counsel. So we hope that much of the work will be done in a committee and brought back.
Representative Tui?
There is nothing that I've read so far that says, except under page 4, line 4, or each respective commissioner's designee, is there anything that precludes the others from having their own representative if they can't make the meeting so that it's not going to run into legal problems? I mean, I can have one of my staff go if I happen to be on there. Can I or can I?
It is not specifically pointed out in the legislation. However, we feel that also there will be bylaws that this Human Resource Investment Council, once they are established, will develop and will be approved that we feel will meet those requirements, Representative Tui, that if a quorum is hard to come by, then we will have some kind of enabling working document that will allow that to happen.
Thank you.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Bob, I was wondering earlier, you'd mentioned Sunset, but those are on the existing councils that will be rolled into this. And I think the size of this council will be scrutinized real closely. And I think what we will need is some verification that the federal law is really driving this size, because I can see many people trying to whittle this down. And if it's not going to work whittled down, then we need something to indicate why we better leave it alone. And another thing, if what I understand, federal legislation is just being worked on now. It is not passed yet. So there may be some changes in that, too, as it goes along, as far as how, you know, these numbers, the size of this council may need to be. So I'm thinking now of a possible sunset clause on this so that it will come back and be revisited by statute as opposed to needing a bill to go through the process to even get it before us. So you might address that, or has that been discussed, and is it a complete off the table, or might it be well received?
I think you raise a very good point. The situation at the federal level is so fluid right now, Representative Davis, that we are operating under our best case scenario, that we feel that there will always be federal monies coming to states to help with job training and vocational education components of a state plan. We envision this council to meet the federal requirements presently in place at the minimum, and that we hope that the federal laws will not change so drastically. There always will have to be somebody here to accept the funds and somebody to disperse the funds, and we feel that if we look at the membership, and if you look at it very closely, we have the line agencies that we feel need to be identified: the Department of Education, the Department of Labor, the Department of Community and Regional Affairs. We feel that these are very, very needed agencies that need to be at the table. Also envisioned there is labor. Labor needs to be at the table on this. Private sector needs to have the majority. As we look at that, there needs to be some sort of an Alaska Native component there through the regional training employment opportunities. If we could find one person identified within this legislation to do away with, I assure you we would have. We would have loved to have brought to you a 12-member board to replace 38 members. We could not do it legally. And I think this board itself, if it could pare its way down, even in a state as wide and diversified as Alaska, to narrow its focus, to narrow its opportunity, it may well envision itself doing so. But I think right now, to envision that we could get by in the state of Alaska with regional representation, cultural sensitivity, governmental and non-governmental entities, as well as a private sector majority, I doubt whether we can get by with less.
Representative Toohey?
Just a question off the top of my head. If in the next 3 or 4 years or 2 years or whatever we decide to consolidate departments, there'll be no problem within this. I mean, this won't be absolute mandatory. This Community and Regional Affairs will. I mean, we don't ever know, do we?
We never know, Representative Toohey, and how well put.
Did I say that? Don't anybody get panicky.
No.
I was going to ask you which one you're talking about.
This is true. And it will, of course, always come back through the budgetary process.
Thank you.
Representative Robinson.
Yeah, Bob, I was curious, under the one position, do you envision that position being in Anchorage or Juneau? What's the Fairbanks?
Well, think carefully. It may have an impact on Bill.
It's going to have a real impact.
Now let me put on my tap shoes here.
You have that, all
right. Representative Robinson, we feel very strongly that with the sunset provisions in the bill is that we don't want to anticipate what the council's, these people, Sarah Scanlon spoke to 10 years of development and working towards this effort. We don't want to prejudge what they would plan to be the most effective delivery system for vocational education and job training. The three councils that are proposed, and the fourth, of course, school to work, as Representative Toohey said, is a natural. It is a natural. We are already beginning to plan with that group. We hope that they are going to, they're all on parallel lines right now. We would like them, once this enabling legislation allows them to look at a sunset provision out there, to sort of converge their lines on their own, with their own plans, and work together to come up with a staffing pattern, with a regional representation on the ERIC, and then we would know what they envision would be the most effective use of the dollars that are available. And so I don't think we're prejudging that right now.
Gene Kelly would have been proud of you.
Thank you.
Can I borrow them?
We will close public testimony. As this is the first time we've heard this bill, my inclination is to not rush the committee, but I'm available or amenable to the advice of the committee. Do you feel you have a significant grasp of the legislation before we move on, or would you be more comfortable if we were to wait over the weekend until Tuesday? Representative Rice?
I would go ahead and put forth the motion to move it. I mean, I of course, I've been following the issue for the past couple of years, and I feel fairly comfortable with it.
I'm concerned about the number of the membership. I thought we were going to go to a subcommittee, so I didn't ask any questions.
Yeah.
Excuse me.
Yes?
I'm going to call in Anchorage.
ask about training council. And maybe I can answer your questions, Representative Davis, about the size.
It's Representative Rookberg.
Rookberg, I'm sorry.
Yeah, and go ahead and would you, did you want to address the question about size?
One of the things that this bill that you have before you will take the three councils, which now consist of 40 members, which are doing employment and training in the state of Alaska, and reduce them down to 23. And if we're concerned about size, we were concerned about cost. First step right there. The second item that we will need to be aware of is that we're doing this under the 1992 JCPOA amendment. So no matter what happens in Congress, this legislation is still valid and we can do this. And it allows us the flexibility that we're striving for in employment training issues in the state. So we're just completely correct in what we can do. I think it will be in the long run more effective and more efficient for Alaskans. And I think the Alaskans are our most important resource that I think we should make this a priority.
Kind of question.
Because certainly when we talk about mining, oil industry, timber, we certainly don't mind talking about selling them there and spending the money, but we don't talk about, you know, that type of development with Alaskans sometimes. So I would encourage you to support the legislation and move it through the legislature this year. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll let you save your financial justifications for the Finance Committee. They will be happy to hear them. Yes, Representative Tuohy.
How many meetings do you think we're going to have a year?
Well, the three councils now meet at least quarterly. I know that Vocational Education GCOVE meets even perhaps. They meet quarterly, too. So we're talking about 12 meetings right now. I would say we'll go down to 4 consolidated meetings.
Let me point out we've got quite a bit more work for the committee today. We've spent an hour. If we have additional questions that can be answered today, let's deal with them. If the committee feels like they would like to do some more research and bring it up again next week, let's make that decision and then proceed along those lines. Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I don't have a problem with moving it along or subcommittee either way. If we do move it along, there is a few questions I'd like to ask Mr. Rubidoux, and they're not real intensive. Bob, on page 4, line 6, it indicates in the makeup of the council 4 additional representatives of education, 1 from local public education, 1 from secondary vocational education. I don't see a distinguish between those two, as opposed to if you're looking at a, I don't know what you'd call the basic education in public schools, and of course the public schools do have vocational education. So you're separating those two things from public education.
Well, we are, Representative Davis, but I'll tell you, if we could get you as an advocate for school to work, we would like to erase those barriers. We feel that all education leads towards work, and that we would like to have that differentiation eliminated in any statute. However, I think what we're looking at here is perhaps that we would not preclude someone, perhaps in a middle school, who would like to be involved in this. And then within the secondary vocational education, we feel that that is a very important component now of the GECO and would be in working with educational, high school educational facilities. And then from the post-secondary vocational education institution, we look at these as perhaps not only the public but the private vocational education institutions. So in this 4 membership is part of the 15% requirement. So this is mandated. So,
and then another follow-up question, Mr. Chairman, on line 9, it said 4 representatives of business and industry. And then you're breaking it down there a little bit. And could the member on subparagraph 7, you've got at least one representative from an organization representing employment trainees of natives, could one of those 4 be that one?
Yes.
Okay, I'm just looking at it.
We're trying to give as much flexibility as possible. And to be culturally sensitive, regionally sensitive, we're not trying to paint anybody into a corner.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Other questions? Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'd like to pursue the line of questioning of Representative Davis in terms of the members on the council. Is there anything that required by federal statute that requires the lieutenant governor to be on the commission?
No, there does not.
Is there anything in federal statute, Mr. Chairman, through the chair, that requires that the commissioner of commerce and the commissioner of community and regional affairs be on the commission?
No, there is not.
It's indicated in here that there's a policy call as to ensuring a private sector majority. And I guess squeezing the best I can out of 23 members, I can only find 9 that might even be called public-private sectors. Could you tell me how this breaks out?
Only 9?
Right. I mean, could you explain what, maybe you have a different definition of the private sector than I do.
Well,
excuse me to interrupt. I'm feeling a pressure of time. I think what I would like to do is have Representative Roper, Representative Toohey, and Representative Bryce work with you to answer those questions and schedule us for Tuesday. Will that work with?
That'll be fine. I'm at chair.
Representative Bryce, Toohey, and Roper, and come back with a questions answer recommendation on the bill on Tuesday, and we will hear it first thing Tuesday.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll move on to House Bill 309 with our thanks for those who testified on 280. And is Representative Martin in gunshot range?
That's not Thomas.
Yeah. All right. We have a representative of the representative.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee. Representative Martin is in finance, actually debating gaming again. So stay clear of the fifth floor.
Knowing we're not going to hear from him for the next several days.
That's right.
Would you please go ahead?
Sure, thank you. HB 309 is basically an attempt to curb the current University of Alaska statewide system shortage of housing needs. Specifically, we're looking at the University of Alaska Anchorage, Southeast, and the Ketchikan extension. The bill is fairly straightforward. It's an authorization bill, and we believe that the Board of Regents have worked out a significant plan with Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, and hence we have HB 309 and House Concurrent Resolution 18, which is simply an endorsement resolution. We do have backup material for all three projects, and we also have both the chancellor from the university in Anchorage and from the campus here in Juneau to testify, as well as some students, and I think AHFC's director is here as well. So rather than waste a lot of time, if they'd like to.
No questions for Mr. Anderson at this point. You'll be with us. And Ms. Redman, would you like to lead off?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, my name is Wendy Redman, Vice President for the statewide system. And the chancellors are here to give you their own compelling testimony about the need for housing. But I wanted to say just a couple of things to clarify. I've had some questions about what appears to be sort of a more complicated procedure to get this done so that you understand why we had to do things the way we did. The concurrent resolution number 18 is a bill which authorizes AHFC to go forward with the housing, the 3% housing bonds for us. And we've been working with AHFC for several years on a variety of plans for them to involve themselves with our student housing provisions. House Bill 309, which goes with it, is an authorizing bill. There are currently statutes which require the university to get a separate authorization, if we are going to incur debt service in excess of $1 million, which this will, our housing debt will go to help pay off the 25-year bonds. There may well be a third piece to put all of this together, which will come probably in the front section of the budget bill, if that's where we need it, which would then authorize HFC to spend their reserves back to HFC from their reserves back to an expenditure account, which is a third piece of it. I also need to point out that this bill is really linked absolutely to House Bill 281, which this committee will be hearing next week, which is part of the AHFC funding for the deferred maintenance of the University of Alaska. That bill also includes provisions, House Bill 281, which protects AHFC assets so that it can, in fact, do the kinds of projects that we envision here. Without that kind of protection of AHFC's assets, we will not be allowed to use them, nor do I believe that they would in any way go forward with approval for our student housing provisions. So I want to make sure everybody understands that these bills, while they may not appear to be linked at this point, they are absolutely integral to each other. So I will let the chancellors give you their testimony on the housing. Thank you.
All right. Thank you, Wendy. Let us begin with Chancellor Lynn Marshall. You join us, please. And welcome.
Thank you. Representative Bundy, Representative Toohey, members of the committee, thank you for allowing me to speak to a bill that I think is a creative way of dealing with the problem that we have in Southeast, at least at two of our campuses. As you know, we have been trying to acquire additional housing on the Juneau campus for several years. We were successful this year in having the governor recognize it and include it in his capital budget. The proposal that is contained in House Bill 309 makes sense. We have done the analysis, the fiscal analysis, as to whether or not we can pay for it. We feel we can. With the plan for the Juneau campus is designed, it's be ready to go to bid in a very short period of time. We've been working on that project for a number of years. It will give us an additional 81 beds. We currently have room for 200. This bill also allows us with this money to make some modification to our food service area, which will be necessary because the type of facility we are proposing does not contain kitchen facilities in the building. It's more of the traditional dormitory type, very traditional in the sense of two students to a room, two rooms sharing a bath, does not have kitchen facilities. So we feel that this is a good approach to meeting the problem on the Juneau campus. In terms of Ketchikan, there's $1 million contained here. We have been working on a project in Ketchikan that the community has for close to 10 years. They have come up with a plan that they feel they can support. They have created a nonprofit housing corporation in Ketchikan involving a number of local business people, finance people, etc. This project is supported by the city mayor, the borough mayor, others in that community. This will enable them to go with one of a couple of choices, either a facility that would accommodate 16 students or possibly 32, and I believe will serve that portion of Southeast Alaska very effectively, especially as we see increased traffic between Prince of Wales Island and Ketchikan as a regional center. This would help the community a great deal. I know the community is very strongly behind it. So I would encourage your support for this authorization. I think it's a creative way of dealing with the problem.
Thank you. Representative Bryce.
Quick question, quick clarification maybe. You stated that the housing was in the governor's capital budget. Why do we need it in 309?
Maybe we don't. But we need the housing one way or the other. Hopefully it could prevail in the governor's budget. If it does, we wouldn't have to borrow the money. This would just give us the authority to do that. And rather than bet on one approach or the other, we feel a strong obligation to do whatever we can to get housing for those students.
We feel that up in Fairbanks, too.
Legislation probably having closer relationship to reality than the governor's budget. Moving along. Thank you. Other questions for Chancellor Lynn?
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Chancellor, can you... I'm from Anchorage, so forgive me. I've been at the Ketchikan Airport more times than I care to remember, but I really haven't spent any time in the community. In terms of is not the Ketchikan campus what would be historically previous to the merger part of the community college system historically?
That is correct. Since 1954, they have been in operation as a community college, and they are probably one of three communities that has given annually a local appropriation to the support of that campus through borough tax dollars.
To the chair, could you tell me what the need to have a what it would previously been a commuter type school have any on-campus housing? What would be the necessity of that?
Changing pattern in student interest, mobility patterns. We're seeing over the past few years a very significant increase in the traffic between Prince of Wales and Ketchikan, and a desire on a larger number of students to complete a two-year program, a two-year degree, particularly a two-year AA degree. Whereas this is changing from earlier years, where there was more interest in the occasional course, the single course. Now we see more students who are serious about staying and completing a two-year program. This would help, and this would be particularly helpful for those students who have families and are unable to either acquire or pay for some of the other housing that they might find in Ketchikan.
And excuse me, Mr. Chairman, just one final question. Can you tell me what the student body enrollment is at Ketchikan campus, and also if they do grant other than a two-year AA degree? Or?
I cannot give you the figures off the top of my head, but I think somebody else in this room probably can. But all we grant at the Ketchikan campus are the two-year, the certificate programs, 1 year in duration, or the two-year programs. We do not grant four-year degrees there.
Having lived in Ketchikan some awful long time ago now, I would say that the housing in Juneau and the challenge for housing in Juneau has nothing over the challenge for housing in Ketchikan. No further questions. Thank you, Chancellor.
I'd be happy to provide for you the question on the figures. I'll give it to you. I just don't have them off the top of my head.
And Chancellor Gorsuch, would you like to comment on 309? And welcome.
Thank you, Co-Chairman Bundy, Co-Chairman Tui, members of the committee. My name is Lee Gorsuch. I'm the Chancellor of the University of Alaska, Anchorage. And I'm here to speak on behalf of the students that our President Commissar and the Board of Regents have asked me to serve. I wanted to speak particularly to my primary mission, which is to try to provide high-quality programs that are accessible to the students who'd like to pursue them. And it's on the accessibility question I'd like to speak first. There are four or five types of students who are desperately in need of housing at the University of Alaska Anchorage. The first student would be the one from somewhere else around the state who would like to have an urban experience in Anchorage, but simply their parents would not want them to come to Anchorage if, in fact, there was not some kind of protected domicile for them by way of a dormitory or residence hall. And I've received numerous correspondence from superintendents around the state who've said as much to me in writing. The second are students from around the state who would like to take a specialty course that's only offered at the University of Alaska Anchorage. So, for example, a student who'd like to become a nurse, we offer the only nursing programs of a four-year or a graduate program are offered at the University of Alaska Anchorage. Again, they would like to be able to have access to housing on the Anchorage campus in order to pursue their careers. And that would be true in a number of other fields as well, whether you looked at special education or some other specialized programs, where the Anchorage campus is the only campus that offers those programs. We have another group of students who might, for a variety of reasons, not the least of which being the student status, would be of an indigent nature. That is, they don't have much money. They're simply in need of finding some place that has affordable housing. It's a reasonably safe place, doesn't require transportation. And traditionally, university dormitory housing is one of those that meets that need of the financial circumstances of students. And I might say that as we're pushing somewhat unrelentingly in the eyes of students of increasing the cost of education by raising tuition, the affordability question becomes a very key issue. And affordable housing is one of the issues that many students have to confront. And as you know from the literature we've shared with you, we only have 390 housing units on the campus currently. And we're a very large, substantial campus. This is no longer a question of a small university. We now have 16,000 students taking courses at the University of Alaska in the Anchorage campus alone, and another 5,000 from our extended sites. We're a very significant institution. nationally, you've seen in the data that most universities have somewhere in the vicinity of 35 to 50% of their students are accommodated on housing. In the Anchorage community, we accommodate 2% of our students are afforded the opportunity of having housing on the campus. A fourth class of student who very much is interested in the housing question would be those who'd like to have an international experience. So of the 16,000 students, even if a small percentage of them wanted to spend a year of study abroad or wanted to have an exchange agreement, whether it's in Korea, Japan, somewhere in Western Europe, the only way that exchange works if I can afford the exchange student a place to live on the Anchorage campus. That is, the universities with whom we have an exchange, they extend to our students the opportunity of having student housing. We have no capacity to reciprocate. So there are a large number of students who aren't being served because of our incapacity to offer campus housing. And I'd also like to speak on behalf of some parents who have school-aged children who would like to attend the University of Alaska Anchorage. But their kids would like to have a traditional campus life experience. That is, they'd like to feel like there was an opportunity where they could have meals together, they could have parties together, and hopefully they would also study together. And as it stands now, we don't have that opportunity, so many parents and their children do not think of the University of Alaska Anchorage as one of their options, and they select a university in the lower 48 if they don't pick our sister institution in Fairbanks. And I might say that as the cost of education continues to increase around the country, the University of Alaska Anchorage is a best buy. But it becomes a best buy only if it meets the quality of life that students and parents are looking for. And many parents feel as though if they're going to finance the education, they'd like to at least have one fringe benefit associated with the financing of their education, and that is to get them out of the house.
Where do we vote?
So for the parents of school-aged children in Anchorage, I'm also making an appeal that this warrant your support. As many of you know, and I won't take a great deal of your time, there are a lot of needs in the Anchorage in the Anchorage campus and our extended campuses for a better library that's very undersized. Our student population has outgrown the size of the library. We do not have enough full-time faculty relative to the size of the student population. We have many needs. Those needs require hard general fund dollars. This is a need that's very much present, but we're trying to do it creatively through Alaska Housing Finance. We think Alaska Housing Finance is set up exactly for this type of student. We think it's an appropriate use of Alaska Housing Finance Corporation assets. We think our students are eligible because in almost all instances they would meet any kind of criteria of financial need for eligibility purposes. And most importantly, our experience is that students who are in that first year experience of a dormitory residence hall do better academically. Their grade point averages are higher because they have the attendant restrictions of essentially a study hall, a study life, and the nurturing and support of the residence hall advisors on the campus. So it's also for good, solid academic reasons this makes a significant contribution to the quality of the educational experience of students. I sort of urge your consideration of supporting this. It seems to me that it meets all of our interests of trying to figure out how to do more with less. This does not solve our library problem. It does not solve our faculty resource problem. But at least it increases the issue of accessibility for students who have a need for housing. It's going to increase the quality of the academic experience for those students who have the opportunity to enter the residence halls. And I think it's going to make a significant transforming impact on the community's image and support. What's not written is I've also pledged that I'll raise $1 million in support of the project itself. And I think it's an opportunity for the Anchorage community to come forward and make a financial commitment to the growth and development of the campus. And even though it's a small step, it's a very significant step. And I think symbolically it represents a sense of optimism and a future for the community in the face of all the financial pressures that we're confronting with the decline of oil and its revenues at Prudhoe Bay. So I think for a variety of reasons, this is a very important project for the Anchorage community and for the University of Alaska Anchorage in particular, and I urge your favorable consideration and support.
Thank you. I would ask a question, or I'm going to make some assumptions of what you said about if we have more housing, more convenient for students from outlying areas to attend UAA, that might help us address those incredibly expensive remote campuses that suffer from a lack of cost effectiveness and economy of scale.
Representative Tui.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gorsuch, a question. You will make every effort, if this goes passes and we get this wonderful housing in Anchorage and Ketchikan and Juneau, you will make every effort to fill those 12 months out of the year?
Absolutely. The only way this works financially is for 12-month occupancy. We have exciting plans for summer institutes, programs that will bring high school students who want to have an immersion experience in language, who want to learn about Alaska Native cultures. We have a very ambitious plan to occupy this facility 12 months out of the year.
But not for free.
But not for free.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. So that this may not become a feeding frenzy, you do not have, you have contacted other campuses and they, no others have requested, like Kenai Peninsula College? I mean, there's no request or need there?
We've done a fairly comprehensive survey at the request of the Board of Regents, and to my knowledge, none have come forward requesting similar facilities.
Under the guise of UAA or the UA system?
UA system.
UAF doesn't have any housing needs?
Representative Rice, could you have a question?
Excuse me. Well, we were just saying that, thank
please,
you, Mr.
Go ahead
Chair.
With your question.
Representative Davis had just said, asked whether there had been any other requests for housing construction or housing development. And I guess I'm not clear that the Chancellor had stated that no, there hadn't been, and I was trying to find out in the UA system or in under the UAA umbrella.
Well, the survey was done UA system, but my reference is to the extended sites in the Anchorage area.
Okay, to the Anchorage area. So there are there are needs outside of the Anchorage area.
I can't speak to those.
Okay. That's, yeah.
Representative Roper.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Gorsuch, can you tell me how many on-campus rooms are available now in your system at UAA?
I think it's 398.
398. And that's the 2% of the student body. And you mentioned that the 12-month year-round utilization of the rooms, I suggest if you considered senior citizen seminars, other housing for the summer. It seems to me there's tremendous opportunities in the summer months to
there are enormous potentials, and they're very exciting. The elder hostel types of programs around the country have indicated a very significant contribution that we could make. There's also a significant opportunity for us to bring professional conventions to town who would also be looking for some affordable housing that they couldn't compete with the hotels that are at a charge of $200, $225 a night. But in all instances, it would be of an educational purpose, and I've worked with most of the hotels in Anchorage to ensure that this is in no way any competition with the visitor industry in the Anchorage area.
Let's follow along on that. Mr. Chairman, it seems that the student athlete was perhaps conspicuous by your absence, that we do have a Division I hockey team and other Division II sports. Would that help recruitment of student athletes to the campus?
I think it helps entirely to the overall image of the campus as having a full-fledged program, including some kind of campus life and facility. And I can't overemphasize the importance of what happens when you have a resident capacity physically on the campus to create an atmosphere of an intellectual community. It's very hard just to have an attachment if your only attachment is to a parking space and a classroom. Here's an opportunity for you to actually sit around, have a cup of coffee, have a conversation about what you like or don't like about what's occurring inside the classroom, beginning to do the things that you'd like to do as you explore sort of new horizons and challenges. And the athletes are certainly among that category who would be a direct beneficiary from that.
I might recommend that you want to see the bill put into subcommittee until hell freezes over. Let's not talk about making it a jock palace.
It's one of many items, Mr. Chairman. One of many items.
I heard student athlete and academic, and that somehow they didn't go in the same sentence for me. Well, anyway, let's move along. Chancellor, Representative Rice.
My understanding is that UAA is not considered a residential campus, and that the whole system, and when we're talking about traditional campus life, it's my understanding the Board of Regents and their development of the mission statements for each of the institutions purposely left out UAA, sort of keeping its focus on other things. So I guess my concern is why are we building residences versus libraries? And on top of that, has there been any discussion between the administration at UAA and possibly private consortiums that do this stuff on campus and develop and construct facilities on a 50-year lease? They own the facilities, they run the facilities, and it's out of the state's hair.
Well, the first is I wouldn't be here without the express authorization of the Board of Regents. So this carries their full endorsement and support, and if there had been any sort of prior designation of no housing, it is not the current policy because it reflects their wishes. As far as an option for a library versus a residence hall, I would gladly take a library if that were available. However, a library generates no revenues to make it self-supporting. So unless I could receive a $28 million capital appropriation for the purpose of a library, this project doesn't compete with that at all. That is, this is an auxiliary facility in which the student rents basically retire the debt for the facility. And I might also add that this is a model facility in the sense that the expectations are that the student rents an auxiliary will not only pay the mortgage, but they will also pay for the cost of the residential life program, which is so important for it being on campus. And secondly, it pays for the full operation, maintenance, and replacement cost of the facility as well. So the way this is structured is there will be no future deferred maintenance issues associated with this facility. It is essentially a self-finance with the interest subsidy.
And that's my concern. We're competing with certain members of the private sector when we're doing this. I do know of a number of cases in various other institutions of higher learning where they do contract out not only the construction but the operation and maintenance of these types of facilities and develop those types of same, providing the same type of traditional campus life. I think it's a viable option that I've been pressing my administration up at UAF to look at as well. So I think, you know, if it is viable, and if it's not something the state, or if the state's going to break even on it and that type of thing, I'm not sure that we couldn't find somebody else to come in and we would save our bonding authority.
Representative Bryce, I've had extensive conversations with members of the hotel industry about this particular issue. We looked at the possibility of whether or not this couldn't serve as a hotel in the summer and a student dormitory during the 9 months of the year. And the answer was no. It is true that we can find, I think, private sector support for financing somewhat conventionally our apartment-style houses. But this is a seven-story structure that has a whole different construction element and cost to it. And the conversations I've had with Bob Hickel, with Al Parrish and the others is that this does not work and under any kind of private scenario, but it would work under this low-interest relationship for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And as far as subcontracting out some of the services, those are open issues that we're receptive to in terms of trying to have a very cost-efficient. We have to make money on our auxiliary services or we won't be able to repay the debt. So we're very much receptive to the idea of outsourcing or subcontracting some of these elements like food service in particular.
Thank you. I have a question. Maybe it might touch on some of what I'm hearing Representative Bryce maybe not saying. What is the enrollment in Anchorage, the student enrollment?
Approximately. It's about 15,500.
Okay. And in Fairbanks?
Excuse me, is that FTE or headcount?
That would be a headcount. FTE would be about 10,600.
And Fairbanks? What's FTE? Excuse me.
Full-time equivalent student.
Okay.
It's three FTEs to make one real person.
I think it's in the category around six.
And the housing for Fairbanks? How many beds they have in Fairbanks?
Boy, I don't really know.
Student housing. I mean, not private beds. Just
2,100.
2,100 and Anchorage.
398.
So to me, and I've as a graduate of UAA, our times have changed, and I think we do need increased housing in Anchorage. I think there's no doubt about it. But I'm worried that Fairbanks is afraid they're going to take. It's going to. Well, I forgot my shoes.
If we can
quickly respond, Mr. Chair.
I would like to go back to 309. Fairbanks won't close up. I have some.
No. Thank you.
Well, I'm glad you do. At least we got to the Petrovich building up there, and that might remain open. I don't know. I think the first of all, the question that I'm trying to get answered is that the Board of Regents have developed mission statements for each of the campuses, for the three campuses. And those mission statements do not place Anchorage as being a major residential campus. And that's all I'm saying. Not only that, but there are private contractors that have worked out at the University of Houston and a lot of various other campuses that have built the student housing and developed it and run it without state assistance.
Representative Rice, I'm unaware of any mission statement that has residential campus in its character, but
maybe it's changed since 90 or so.
I wouldn't be here without the authorization of.
No, and I understand that, and I'm not saying that. Okay. I'm not saying
if we could come back to 309. I remember I've been in this system long enough to know that if Regents had originally had their way, there wouldn't have been an Anchorage at all, or UAB. But moving along.
Mr. Chairman, perhaps I'd like to make a brief statement, but perhaps Ms. Redmond would like to clarify this situation for us. Would you like to?
Well, go ahead.
Clarify?
Mr. Chairman, if I may, I'll be very brief. I appreciate what Representative Rice is saying, but the board's position is clearly that Anchorage will not become primarily a residential campus. That is not appropriate for the mission right now. However, you could add three times the amount of housing that UAA is currently seeking, and it would still be substantially below even what an urban university has. This doesn't bring it anywhere close to being a residential campus. A residential campus is a campus where we would expect to see 75 to 85% of the students have housing on campus, and those are the ratios that Fairbanks is looking at, which is a residential campus. So I think that what we're seeking in Anchorage is residence hall, not to turn it into a residential campus. Thanks.
All right, thank you. On 309, we'll stop our sectional jealousies now, and we'll go on to 309. Did you have a question on 309?
Well, I just had a sexual jealousy.
Be careful in your pronunciation of that.
Yes.
All right. Chancellor Gorsuch, thank you very much for being the brunt of our
jealousy.
I would like to, if we could hear all the rest of the testimony, as I said, we still have other business before this committee. If we hear the rest of the testimony, and then we will go to questions if that seems to work. And Bruce Gifford?
I signed up as a visitor not to speak.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm not paying attention. Thank you. Well, I'm glad to see somebody follows directions.
Should we name it?
Okay. Dan Fausch or Bill Howe?
Mr. Chairman, my name is Bill Howe. I'm the newly appointed Deputy Commissioner of Revenue. And Dan Fausch will be joining me as soon as he finds his cup of coffee.
Okay. Dan, well, please begin.
Thank you. I'm here not to address the merits of student housing, but to talk about the proposed involvement of AHFC in the project, specific to the requested subsidy and the assumption that AHFC can go out and raise in new bond issues the $36.5 million that's required to fund the program. If I might walk you through some Jesuitical trained logic on this. For AHFC to raise the $36 million, they have to access the bond markets. Bond sales at competitive and attractive interest rates are a function of having the ability to have the bonds rated as investment grade. Investment grade bond ratings are a function of the investment community having confidence that their bondholders will get paid back the money that they've bought the bonds with, plus interest over the 25 years. It's no secret to most of you in the House that AHFC has recently been put on credit watch by one of the major bond rating agency, Standard & Poor's, where they are evaluating the current A-plus rating that AHFC has, which is well into the middle range of investment grade. Mr. Dan Fowsky, who is the executive director of AHFC, has just returned from a meeting in New York with S&P, and if time permits, we could have him give testimony as to those discussions. In summary, though, the S&P has made, as effective yesterday, a press release that says that they very much like the approach in HB 281 and SB 143, which, as you know, is the governor's effort to program over a five-year period a transfer of funds of capital from AHFC in an orderly manner. The total of the funds transfers will be $270 million over 5 years, including $30 million this year. S&P has reviewed that program and in their press release says they support that program, and if that program is adopted, they will take AHFC off of Credit Watch and reinstate its prior status. The resolution in front of you, if considered outside the total scope of the legislature's intent to how to deal with AHFC, simply adds fuel to the fire on the part of the credit agencies in terms of increasing their apprehension that the legislature will continue to drain funds out of AHFC with no end in sight, and the interest subsidy, in effect, does that, and increases their unwillingness to consider AHFC as an investment-grade bond. Another example that has the attention of the rating agencies is SB 40. Senate Bill 40 will require AHFC to transfer over an 18-month or a two-year period over $400 million with no end in sight back to the general fund, leaving the bondholders exposed to some degree as to their ability to get paid over such a long, protracted period of time.